Welcome back from me, everybody. My name is David Mitra, in case you've not encountered me before. And I'm now going to be giving you a talk about transference of merit and self-surrender. I quite often find myself sitting out here at the beginning, at this stage of the class, looking around and thinking, what on earth am I going to say? Now, you may take from that I don't prepare my talks very carefully. But that wouldn't be true. I do prepare my talks reasonably carefully. I tend to think about what I'm speaking about a few days beforehand, and then the afternoon before I speak, I usually try to put aside a couple of hours or so where I can just focus my mind on the theme that I'm going to be talking about. So my theme this evening is, as I've just said, transference of merit and self-surrender, which is the final stage in the Sevenfold Puja. If you've been coming along for the last 2.5 months, really, you'll be aware that we've been exploring the Sevenfold Puja on these evenings. First of all, Surigupta and Jnanavacha were looking at the Puja, and now, last 3 weeks, Subhadramati, who's not here this evening, couldn't be with us, and myself, we've been looking at the Puja, at the bits that the other two didn't cover, you could say. So what I'm going to say needs to be sort of understood, really, within the framework of that. So let me just very briefly, very, very briefly indeed, just remind you of where we've come. So we've been exploring the Sevenfold Puja, and of course, as that implies, there are 7 stages to the Puja being a Buddhist ritual, Puja meaning worship. And so in the first stage, we sort of prepare ourselves for what's about to happen. It's kind of drama in a way. We prepare the stage, so to speak. We create a beautiful shrine. We create an atmosphere in which it's possible to feel devotion. And we engage in worship of the ideal that, as Buddhists, we hold dear, or revere the ideal that we hold dear. And then we continue this process. We bow down before that image. I suppose that's a kind of worship too. It's a kind of salutation. It's a kind of it's an acknowledgement of the distance that exists between we as we are now and we as we could become, as represented by this figure of the Buddha seated on the shrine. So having sort of acknowledged the ideal in that sort of way, we then commit ourselves to doing that. That's what the next stage of the puja involves, going for refuge. We commit ourselves to putting that ideal into effect in our lives as fully as we possibly can. And having done that, we then undertake to practice an ethical life, and then we undergo a process of a purification through confession. And after that, we then rejoice in the goodness of others. And then after that, we entreat for the teaching. We ask for the teaching, which sort of signifies our receptiveness to the teaching. It's very, very important that we come with a receptive frame of mind. There's no point in coming here, really, unless you really feel that you've got something to learn. And hopefully you do feel that you have something to learn, and that you have something to learn specifically from coming here, coming to this class even. So that's the next stage. The final stage, having done all of that, having sort of prepared the ground so that we can be receptive to the teaching, we then transfer the merit. We perform the final stage of the puja, the transference of merit and self-surrender, which is the culmination of the whole ritual, really. Now, this ritual is part of something much bigger, really. It's a ritual which is devised, if you like, to try to help us to cultivate the attitudes of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva being someone who's dedicated to the attainment of enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. A very big ideal. It's the Bodhisattva is determined over lifetimes, because you've got to bear in mind that within Buddhist tradition, it's taught over lifetimes, you'll become a fully enlightened Buddha, a perfect Buddha, a perfectly enlightened Buddha. Now, it's important to make a distinction here because, for example, the Buddha had many enlightened disciples, but there's only one Buddha, Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha. He became the Buddha because he says that he was the rediscoverer of the way, that the way to enlightenment had not been open until he, through his considerable efforts over many lifetimes, reopened that way again, and thereby became one of the Buddhas. But he had many enlightened disciples, and their enlightenment is the same as the Buddha's enlightenment, but they're not Buddhas. They've gained enlightenment, if you like, on the back of the Buddha. They've not sort of rediscovered the way. They've not sort of opened the path to enlightenment again, as the myth goes. So that they're not Buddhas in that sense, but they are enlightened. But the Bodhisattva path is treading the path which leads to enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That ride is very important, and the attainment of perfect Buddhahood. So this practice is all about trying to sort of develop the necessary attitudes which will ultimately lead to that eventuality. So that gives you the full context. So this puja, this sevenfold puja is very, very important. It's not just simply something that we recite as a Buddhist ritual, although we do that. It's something we're actually trying to cultivate. All those attitudes which are represented in the puja are practices within themselves, practices that we try to take seriously and put into effect in our lives because they lead ultimately to this goal. So it's very much a practice of putting into effect the Bodhisattva ideal. And so when we come to the seventh stage, the culmination of the Sevenfold Puja, what this is really all about is, transference of merits and self-surrender suggests that we're going finally and ultimately beyond ourselves. It highlights really the whole altruistic dimension of Buddhist practice. That's really what it's all about. So there's a lot that can be said about that, and hopefully I'll manage to say something of that sort, something about that in the course of the next 45 minutes or so. So thinking about this earlier, there are a number of themes which occurred to me that I'd like to explore. Whether or not I'll be able to remember them all is another matter. I very often find myself coming here intending to give one talk and giving something totally different. I sometimes wonder where on earth it's all come from. The way I approach this is I dwell upon the theme, over a period of days, and lots of things will occur to me, and they'll be sort of milling around in the back of my mind, just waiting to pop out at the right moment. But sometimes the things that pop out are not quite the things that I was intending to bring to your attention. Anyway, we'll see what happens this evening. This is quite a necessary process, I would say, by the way, because I was very, very struck some time ago when I watched a documentary about Claudio Abbado. Some of you may know who he was. He was a very famous Italian conductor who was for a number of years, I think for 12 years, the principal conductor and musical director of the Berlin Philharmonica. And he's been a source of inspiration to me in a number of ways. But one thing that really struck me when he talked about his own music making and his work as a conductor was the way that he conducted, the way that he made music as a conductor with an orchestra. And I don't know about his early life, but certainly towards the end of the life, he never used a score. He always was conducting from memory. And someone asked him, why do you do that? And he said, If I'm always looking at the score, how can I communicate with the orchestra? How can I hint to them what, you know, how to play? You know, I need to be aware of what they're doing. I need to be looking at them. And so I was quite struck by that. So there's a communication taking place between him and the players, and of course, hopefully between the players and the audience. So I like to have that sort of approach myself with giving a talk. I like to see you all. If I've got notes in front of me, I can't do that properly. I like to be looking around and seeing what the responses are, if there are any. Sometimes there are not. And that in itself is a communication back. But it's a very, very important part of the process of communicating the Dharma. We have to enter into communication with one another. So there's communication coming from you to me, and hopefully from me to you. In fact, the Buddha himself seemed to, well, he obviously approached things in this kind of way. There's a very famous story where, which I think is quite typical, where he found himself about to address a large gathering of people, probably hundreds, maybe even thousands, who knows. But right at the beginning, he was looking around who was out there, trying to suss out, well, who's going to be receptive and who's not. And there's one famous occasion where he spotted someone who'd come. It was a leper, actually. He'd come simply because there's a large gathering of people. He thought, alms, food. So he'd come to the gathering for that reason. Not because he wanted to listen to the Buddha specifically, but the Buddha had his eye on him. And he directed his discourse directly to him throughout. Not that anybody else didn't benefit from that, of course, but this particular individual later gained enlightenment. Now, don't worry. When I look around the room, I'm not sort of trying to single out the most receptive person in the room, but I am trying to be aware of you all as best I can. It's very, very important when talking about the Dharma. It's a communication. Okay, so transference of merit and self-surrender. There were a number of things which struck me when I was dwelling upon this, especially this afternoon, which are sort of inseparably bound together, really. The first thing is that, of course, if you're talking about altruism, it always brings to mind compassion, doesn't it? And in Buddhist tradition, compassion and wisdom are inseparable. You can't have compassion without wisdom. You can't have wisdom without compassion at the highest level. So universal compassion, in the Buddhist sense, implies infinite wisdom. So those two things are inseparable. But thinking about compassion in a different sort of way, it occurred to me also, wherever you can't really separate compassion from suffering, can you? I mean, so compassion is a response to suffering. So compassion and suffering go together also. And then thirdly, what struck me was that, thinking about, the practice of the Dharma life, my own practice of the Dharma life even, any seriously committed Buddhist practice of the Dharma will involve two things. One is working in some way or other for the benefit of others. It has an altruistic element to it. And the other is working on your own mental states, trying to become a better human being. And I think actually these two things, again, are very, very, you can't really separate them out. Certainly I can't separate them out from my own life. I try to work on both, ultimately with the hope that one day, of course, wisdom and compassion will arise. So that's very much part of our approach here. We engage in practices which, in some way or other, will help others, or we may go out and do work which helps others, but we also work on our own mental states. And that's particularly important. I mean, it's very easy, for example, to be moved by the state of the world. Usually the state of the world is pretty grim. I think it's always grim, actually. It always seems to be grimmer than it's ever been before at any particular moment. But it's the nature of the samsara. It's the nature of conditioned existence. You know, for example, to link back in with one of the other themes I just mentioned, is the universality of suffering. And you can't live without escaping suffering. You can't live without seeing suffering. Suffering surrounds us all the time, whether we see it or not. Sometimes that suffering is hidden. It may be something deeply hidden within someone's own mind and heart. We don't know what is going on in other human beings very often. They may be experiencing the most intense pain, emotional pain, mental pain, or whatever. That pain can be just as severe as the kind of pain that one might think of or associate with people who are stateless, who become refugees or whatever. One of my young friends has just come back from a refugee camp in Greece, where he's been helping out. He was telling me about someone who's from Iraq, who he got to know quite well and became good friends with. And the background to this man's life is not easy. It's not pleasant. I won't tell you what he told me, but while this young man is waiting to hopefully gain asylum in Greece, he fell in love with someone else in the camp, and this young woman was not interested in him, and it caused him a lot of pain. And even though there was a more serious reason why he was in that camp in the first place, why he'd fled Iraq, this was what was preoccupying his mind. This was what was giving him the greatest pain. So even in a situation like that, the sort of mental, emotional pain that we experience through life may sort of overshadow even, the fact that he was a stateless person. And if he's returned to Iraq, which looks unfortunately extremely likely, he'll be facing some pretty grim situation when he gets back. But what's affecting his mind in the moment is that he's heartbroken because the young woman he fell in love with did not fall in love with him and wasn't even interested. Suffering is universal, and it takes many, many forms. Now, where am I going? I've lost my thread. Don't worry, I'll find it. I should come back really to what I should be really talking about. This is all part of my preamble, really, but there were themes I wanted to come back to and probably will if I've got time. We're talking about transference of merit and self-surrender, and the fact that this stage of the puja implies the altruistic dimension of the Buddhist life, the spiritual life. The fact that there's a self-regarding dimension when we work upon our mental states, when we practice ethics and so forth, and the fact that we also have to work for the benefit of others. These things are highlighted by this. And so we get this idea of transferring merit. So this needs quite a bit of unpacking, really. It's quite complex. Well, it's simple in a way, but it's quite rich in application in the wider Buddhist tradition. So you have this idea of punya, which is the Sanskrit word punya, which is translated as merit. And it's very important to Buddhists across the world to generate merit. What merit amounts to, effectively, are the consequences of acting skillfully. You act in an ethical way, in what Buddhists would call a skillful way, and there will inevitably be positive consequences for you. Positive doesn't always mean pleasurable, by the way, but that's another matter, another talk perhaps. We're not going to go down that one this evening. But this is fundamental to Buddhism. In fact, it's so fundamental, you find that it's mentioned in the very first verse of the Dhammapada, one of the most famous of all Buddhist texts. The very first verse mentions effectively that if you act skillfully, then you will experience positive consequences. So that's a general sort of principle. So merit refers to those positive consequences, the results of skillful action. Now, what you very often find in the Buddhist East is that many Buddhists are preoccupied by the idea of gaining merit. They want to gain merit, and they want to practice the precepts and worship the Buddha and so forth, they want to gain merit because they've got their eyes set upon a favorable rebirth. Rebirth in heaven, preferably. Now, this is the sort of thing which sometimes when we mention this in a Western context makes people a little bit twitchy, because it's something that you seem, which sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? If you behave well, you'll go to heaven. If you behave badly, you'll go somewhere else. But within a Buddhist context, it's not quite as black and white as that. Yes, if you perform meritorious deeds in the course of a life and they characterize your life, it's quite possible that you'll be born in a state of happiness. Normally, we'd associate that with, in terms of the wheel of life, which we explored last session, pre-Christmas, it would be associated with rebirth within one of the realms of the devas, of the gods, one of the heaven realms. It means when your life is going very well, very easily, very relaxed, no problems. So that's the sort of thing you can expect, or at least hope for, if you practice. If you develop skillful mental states, make an effort to overcome your unskillful mental states. So many Buddhists in the world will practice in order to develop merit simply for that reason. They want a good rebirth. They want to go to heaven, if you like. But within the context of the Sevenfold Puja, within the context of the Bodhisattva ideal, that falls a long way short. Because the overall purpose of the Buddhist life, the true purpose of the Buddhist life, is to gain enlightenment. And that means going way beyond any sort of rebirth within a heaven realm, or anything that you might conceive of that sort. Because the heaven realms and the wheel of life, which some of you will be familiar with, are impermanent, like everything else. And rebirth in the heaven realm won't last. It will last for a period, but then even the devas, even the gods, ultimately are subject to the law of impermanence. They die. So being reborn in heaven doesn't really solve anything. It doesn't really ultimately solve the problem of the universality of suffering. The only thing that can deal with that is enlightenment. So in order to sort of try to make sure that we don't get trapped in this idea of, well, developing merit for its own sake, even just sort of practicing in a very, even practicing altruism in a way in order that you might develop merit, that kind of attitude has to be, it has to be dealt with, if you like. And so we do that by transferring our merit. So that, let's say, in the context of puja, towards the end of the puja, when you reach this stage, you're acknowledging the fact that you've engaged in this ritual, which is considered to be a skillful action. But you're not doing it just for yourself. You're going to transfer whatever good may come to you as a result of that for the benefit of others. It's that kind of spirit that it's trying to inculcate. And so this is the attitude of the Bodhisattva, that everything that the Bodhisattva does for the benefit of others. And this is the Bodhisattva ideal. And at the heart of that ideal is compassion. So this idea of transferring merit is very much connected with that. So let's come back to the idea of compassion itself again. And the whole idea of altruism and altruistic activity. I think many people nowadays will see that things in the world, as I've said earlier, are a bit grim. And they would like to do something about that. At least they might think that they would like to do something about that, but they don't know what to do. Because once you start looking at what's out there, it's so vast, you can feel quite helpless. What can you do? What can I, as an individual, do to help alleviate, for example, the extent of the suffering in the Middle East, or as I've seen for myself in a place like India? What can I do? The scale of human suffering, the scale of the poverty, etc., is so mind-boggling. It would be very, very easy to just to become kind of bewildered by that, overwhelmed by it, and think, well, I can't do anything. But actually, you can. When I first took up the practice of Buddhism, I definitely had a sense that I wanted to do something which would help to make the world a better place. And I had a sense of how much terrible suffering there was in the world. I'd already been to India by this stage. I'd seen it. I've seen it on the streets of Delhi and elsewhere in India, and I found it a very, very painful experience because it was so vast, and I couldn't really deal with it. I found it very difficult to absorb that, actually, to take it in. But about a year later, a year after I'd returned from India, I was only there for a few weeks, actually, but it left a very, very big impression upon my mind. I become aware of other aspects of the painfulness of existence. I wanted to do something about that, but I felt inadequate. So I took up the practice of meditation. I came along to the first centre of what used to be called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order in North London, in Archway. And I've never, ever looked back, actually. But what was interesting was that, of course, the first thing I did was learn how to meditate. So I took up meditation practice. I did the same practices that we teach you, the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. And gradually I noticed that something was changing in me. I was becoming more aware. I was becoming more emotionally positive. I was becoming less prone to my irritability and resentments and so forth. And on the basis of that, I felt gradually that bit by bit, I had something to offer other people, something of worth. And that process has continued from my early 20s throughout the rest of my life. And it's not just continued, it's increased. So that's what's happened to me. I never thought, for example, I'd ever go back to India. I didn't want to go back to India. I'd seen enough. I found it very painful being in India. I couldn't wait to get out of there once I'd got there. But I found myself having to go back to India because of certain responsibilities I'd assumed within Sri Ratna. And I used to go to India eventually once a year. And that way I was able to see what was possible, even for me, to make a difference to the lives of others, to help bring about a positive change in their lives. I imagine most of you will be aware we have a number of centres in India, and the numbers of people involved in our centres in India is mind-boggling. I mean, it's hundreds, it's thousands. And so going to India, going back to India on many occasions, as I have done in the course of my life, I've been able to take something back there which has been a positive benefit to others. And so I've been able to sort of put this into effect. I could not have imagined that when I first came along, because I found that, you know, the scale of human suffering was such, it was impossible to do anything about it. But we can do something about it. And this is what this stage of the puja reminds us of, in a way, and also points to how we can go about doing that and how far we can take that. But let's come back down to earth a little bit, away from the heights of enlightenment. As quite a few of you probably know by now, because I've been talking about it so much, just over a week ago I went to see the film Capernaum. I've seen it twice now. And this is a film which, it's a very interesting film from a number of points of view. I think it's quite an exceptional piece of work. And it basically focuses on the life of a young refugee boy in Beirut. But I watched an interview with Nadine Labaki, who directed this film, created this film, and I found it very, very interesting because what brought this film into existence was that, she's been living in Beirut in Lebanon all her life, and gradually the scale of the refugee crisis there had grown and grown and grown, and she was beginning to feel angry about it, frustrated. As so many people would feel, what do you do about it? So she decided she would make a film about it. Now, what's interesting to me is the fact that this started with her feeling angry and frustrated. But what the way she went about making that film sort of was a way, if you like, of channeling positively that, let's say, less than positive response to the situation. She wanted to do something about it. And so what she did, she and her team, they interviewed hundreds of refugee boys on the streets of Beirut, or refugee children. I imagine they interviewed girls as well, but in the end they chose to focus the film on the life of a boy. And the way she went about it was this. She describes it in the interview. She said, what goes on in that little boy's mind? What's his world like? How does he view the society in which he lives? How does he view someone like me? And so on. She really tried to sort of imagine her way into the lives of the characters that she created. And I think she succeeds extraordinarily well, which is why it's such a good film. One reason why it's such a good film. So that's the way she went about it. It took her about 4 years to make the film, to do the necessary research, and so on and so forth. But the interesting thing for me here is the fact that it started with anger. And very often, this is people's response towards these sort of situations. It's not one of compassion, it's one of anger. So how do you deal with that? Well, she dealt with it in a very, very creative way. She made a film which possibly will make a difference to the lives of some people in Beirut. She made a film which could potentially change the attitudes of some people in the Lebanon and beyond towards people in this unfortunate situation. One of the interesting things about the film is that although she began from a point of anger, there's no hint of that in the film. You don't get the sense at any point, at least I don't, and I've seen it twice now, that she's judging anybody. Her empathy is not just for the boy in the street. Her empathy clearly extends to all the other characters, especially to, I would say, to the boy's parents who are less than ideal. Her empathy extends that far. And so what seems to me to have happened to her, I mean, she may disagree with this, but looking at it from a Buddhist perspective, what seems to have happened was that this anger got transmuted into something positive. But very often that doesn't happen. We might get angry about the state of, let's say, homeless people on the streets of London. We might get quite indignant about it. It's very easy to sort of get worked up about it and to become self-righteous about it and blame others, the government, whatever. I don't know who you'd blame. I was coming back from a concert the other evening I just left the festival hall, I think it was on Saturday night, and as I was walking back towards Waterloo Station, there was someone out on the street begging, clearly a homeless person, and someone behind me just said to this person, it's not your fault, mate, it's the establishment's. It's not your fault. And then walked by. I don't think that particularly helped. But I'm not even quite sure. I mean, I don't know who he would identify as the establishment either. Perhaps he was just trying to allay his own sense of guilt at the fact that, you know, perhaps he doesn't lead such a difficult life. But there are all sorts of ways that we react against the suffering that we encounter. But in the instance I've just mentioned in this film, that's not what happens. But the key to it is empathy. In a different sort of context, and I won't say very much more, this perhaps will be my last point before I open it out to questions, but I think that if you want to change the world for the better in any way, the key thing really is empathy, and that means listening to others, just as Nadine Labaki did to the kids on the streets of Beirut. She listened to them. They interviewed hundreds. She listened to their stories, tried to feel her way into their world, empathised with them. And this is a very different kind of story, really, but it's sort of quite, to my mind, there's a connection. And that is that, there's a film which was made a number of years ago. By the way, I do read books and do other things. I don't just watch films. And I run film nights at the LBC, but I'm not really a film buff. Just a little bit of one. But a few years back, there's a film made called The Fog of War. Did any of you see it? Yeah, it's a very, very good film. It's a documentary. But it's a film, basically, it's an interview with Robert S. McNamara. And Robert S. McNamara was the Secretary of State for Defense for President Kennedy and his successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson. So he was the Secretary of Defense at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I lived through. I don't know how many, there might be one or two other people present who did. One person, at least two. Okay. Yeah, okay, good. It's a long time ago, but boy, I remember it. It was very, very tense. It was about as close as you could get to nuclear war, as you can imagine, a worldwide conflict. And I wouldn't have been sitting here now, none of you would be in this room now, had someone triggered, pressed the relevant button. What I didn't realize was just how close that came. And this is one of the frightening things which is revealed in this film. It's a very interesting film from a number of points of view. Basically, it's lessons learned from the life of Robert S. McNamara. In other words, McNamara reflects back over 80 years of his life and draws a number of lessons. I think there are 12 from them. And one of those lessons was empathize with your enemy. It was particularly relevant to the Cuban Missile Crisis, without going into the details of that. This came to mind partly because this young friend of mine who's been in Greece had seen a sticker on the back of a toilet door, as it happens. And on this, at the top of this sticker, it said in English, no fascism, no Islamophobia, no homophobia, right down through a whole long list of contemporary prejudices and vices. Right at the bottom, it said, no discussion. Well, to my mind, there's a tremendous irony in that. I won't unpack that. I think you can work it out for yourself. You might be concerned about these things, but really, is that going to help? It's not likely to. If you want to change the world, you've got to listen to those who hold a different position from your own. You don't have to agree with it. You don't have to. You don't have to agree with it, but you must listen to what they have to say. You must try to see things from their point of view if you want to change things for the better. In other words, there has to be communication. Coming back to one of my a point I made right at the beginning, really, We can't move forward as human beings without communication. And that sometimes might mean listening to things that we don't want to hear, if we want to change things for the better. So anyway, this is one of the lessons from Robert S. McNamara. If you want to see this film, by the way, I'm showing it here in June. Come along. Yes, so empathize with your enemy. If there are people who you find difficult, painful to be with, whatever, we've all got people we put in the fourth stage, haven't we? Just think about empathizing with your enemy and how that could change things for you. If we're in a state of anger or hatred, what that means is that we can't see things clearly. Because anger distorts, hatred distorts. We hear a lot about prejudice, which quite rightly, but we don't hear enough about the distortions of hatred and of anger. And that means in our own hearts. And every human being is prone to hatred and to prejudice. You know, nobody has a monopoly of hatred or anger or prejudice. They're in every human heart. It's part of what it means to be human. Or, well, let's say less than human. But it's part of what we have to work with. So be open to others. Be open to their position. Try to understand, perhaps, why they have certain views and attitudes. There may not be a very positive basis to it, or there may be, you don't know. You won't find out unless you listen to them, unless you enter into some sort of discussion with them, into communication. So no fascism at the top, no discussion at the bottom. It's going to go nowhere. It's probably going to make things worse. Okay? So, gosh, that's not a very positive note to end on. So let me just pause for a moment. I don't know, sometimes you just have to leave the challenge with you. So now I'd like to open things up to you for questions. We've got about 15 minutes. If there's anything that I've said this evening which has sort of piqued your interest, anything you'd like to ask me to unpack further, or whatever, please do. Yeah.
Yeah. Situation, and I do wonder whether it collectively lessens people's empathy, because there's so many homeless people that it's just something that you become more habituated with. And I was wondering what that kind of like Buddhist response to this homelessness situation is. What do you think makes it, how do you act to make it better? It kind of frightens me.
Right, yeah. Okay, I'll come back to it in a moment, but let me tell you something about my experience in India. I've been to India, as you probably gather, a number of times, and India is full of beggars. Wherever you go, there are beggars. There are far more beggars than you'll see on the streets of London. And I very, very rarely give anything to beggars in India. Now, it's not because I'm trying to ignore the scale of the problem, but I have to be realistic about what I individually can do. I know, for example, if on the streets of Bombay I gave some money to someone, you know, there'd be suddenly a whole pack of beggars surrounding me if I'm not careful. That's the sort of thing that can happen. I decided the only way that I could deal with that was just not give in those circumstances. Occasionally I have done, when it's been quite clear to me that someone's genuinely hungry, for example, I buy someone a meal or whatever, but money I would never give. That might sound a bit hard, but I've got to be realistic about what I can actually change for the better. With regards to people on the streets in London, I think you just got to try and work out your own, respond as positively as you can. You might choose to give, you might choose not. I don't think you should feel bad if you choose not to do so. But some of my friends frequently give to people on the streets. I tend not to actually, but I don't feel bad about it. I don't like the fact that they're there. I don't mean in the sense that I don't like them individually. I don't like the fact that the problem is there, is what I should say. But it is there. The way I try to deal with that is, okay, I'm trying to do something positive with my life. I'm trying to do something which will help other people in some way or other have better lives. But there's a limit to what I can do. I don't know whether that really answers your question, but that's my own attitude. But you'd have to ask different people. You might ask some of the other order members present, then they would give you a completely different response. You might find that some of them are very concerned and want to do something to alleviate that situation. But for me, the most important thing is there's a bigger problem, which is how to alleviate suffering, human suffering, well, not just human suffering, but sentient suffering on the biggest scale. And to me, the answer to that is clear. You make the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, available to the greatest number of people possible. And the more people who are working on their minds or mental states, practicing ethics and so on, there are, the more likelihood that is that there will be, over a long period of time, no doubt, some effect within the wider society. It may seem a bit of a non-answer to you, but I've seen the impact of teaching the Dharma in India upon the lives of the people that we are in contact there, who are the Dalits, people who come from an ex-untouchable background. I've seen the positive influence that the Dharma has had upon them and their lives. So, and you know, on quite a broad scale, actually. So some things can be done, but you have to be realistic about what you can do. Find the best way of dealing with it, really. But I think it is important. I think it's important for everybody to have some way of engaging in altruistic activity, but always on the basis of positive emotion. It's no use doing it on the basis of anger or hatred. It must be on the basis of metta. You need that because, partly because without it you can't see clearly. That links in with the idea of the connection between wisdom and compassion, actually. You need wisdom to give wise, to engage compassionately, to engage in compassion, yeah. Okay?
Just picking up on that question, specifically, with many homeless charities, we'll say it's much better to give to homeless charity than to individual people on the street. Even so, when you pass someone by, it feels like you're risking the harming of your own heart when you walk past them.
Yeah.
Don't give anything to them. So just picking up on that question, I think it's, for me anyway, it's really a question about what I understand about Buddhist teaching, how you become more skillful in your responses.
Yeah.
Because to walk past someone on the street and allow yourself to feel that kind of hardening of heart when it's happening, well, that's not what you want to do. So it's quite a simple question about how you do what you might intellectually think is the right thing without actually causing your sensitivity to degrade.
Yeah, well, it is potentially a problem that by not giving, that you harden, you become hardened, as you say. I suppose if you're practicing the Metta Bhavana, for example, that won't happen. But, you know, we're not all of us responsible for all the suffering out there. You know, and there's a limit that any one individual human being can do. I think just simply by developing positive emotion, you're helping. There's a paucity of positive emotion in the world. But, you know, if you become more and more emotionally positive yourself, it'll have a positive impact upon those you encounter in whatever circumstances. And maybe you will be moved from time to time to give. But you could not possibly give to every beggar on the street of London. But maybe you can give to a charity, as you suggest. Yeah? Sorry?
Just in those circumstances, particularly when I'm walking home.
Yeah.
connection. So bring that cold street link. So particularly when it's really cold out, you can actually recall people who look like they're about to fall asleep on the street. So they've sort of got their toothpaste ready and everything.
Mm.
And the charity can make contact with that person. So for me, it was just a way of, I guess, trying to help and being able to I guess, alleviate my own suffering with their suffering.
Mm. Yeah.
So I've told somebody that this person would have had to sleep on the street and they will contact them and try and get them into a hostel. So it's particularly cold.
Yeah, well, obviously, if that's good for them, and it means that your heart isn't hardened to their plight. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah?
Maybe a simple question. I'm sorry if it's Bodhisattvas, do they suffer?
Ah, interesting point. I suppose a fully enlightened bodhisattva, no, because the whole someone who's fully enlightened, in other words, a fully enlightened bodhisattva is a Buddha, actually. But no, they don't suffer in the sense that we normally speak of it. But there's suffering, I suppose, because, for example, towards the end of his life, right in the final days of his life, the Buddha got quite ill, and he clearly suffered. But that was the suffering of the physical body. He was beyond the kind of suffering generating the kind of karma, to use that word, the karma, the sort of consequences of actions which would create further emotional suffering and so forth. But you know, as long as the Buddha was embodied as a physical being, he's bound to experience physical pain and suffering. That cannot be avoided. Sorry, have I answered your question? I'm not sure I have.
I think so. Like, I guess I'm trying to understand the nature of suffering and how you overcome suffering. Does being a bodhisattva and, I suppose, transferring merit, as you said, and all that, but being enlightened, does that necessarily lead to the cessation of suffering?
Well, that's the definition of enlightenment, the cessation of suffering. The Buddha taught famously, putting it very, very simply, when asked, what do you teach? He said, I teach suffering and its end. So what lies between suffering and its end is the path, the Buddhist path.
So if I understand it, then you feel physical pain, you might feel mental pain, even emotional pain, but at some level, because you're enlightened, suffering is stopped. Because it's sort of not...
You won't be generating any further pain, if you see what I mean. You're not reacting. You certainly wouldn't be reacting to pain. I mean, very often when we experience pain, we react to it. Usually, we don't want it. We want to push it away. But you know, as long as an enlightened being is still physically embodied, there will be what's called the fruits of past unskillful actions will still be felt. But you won't be reacting to that. There would be no reaction at all. So you won't generate further karma, which would cause rebirth within the samsara.
So this is sort of maybe a little bit of an implication of what you're saying, is that it's your reaction to the pain that's causing the suffering.
Well, yes. Well, it intensifies the suffering. I mean, for example, 2 years ago, I went through chemotherapy and radiotherapy for a serious cancer. It was not pleasant. But I knew, as soon as I received my diagnosis, that the biggest battle that I had, that I faced ahead of me, was not with my body, but with my mind. And I was determined as hell that I wasn't going to react to what was going to come. And it wasn't pleasant at all. It was a nightmare, actually, at times. But in a very odd way, looking back at that time now, strange to say, I kind of miss it. I don't miss the physical pain, but it was like my mind was so focused. So I was so determined not to lapse into negative thinking about, you know, my existential predicament, that I felt I was occupying a totally different space from the one I was accustomed to. And you can kind of... Well, let me quote you a fascinating a proverb from Tibet, which is that you can make yourself comfortable in hell if you go the right way about it. And I found a way of doing that. But fundamentally what I was doing was not reacting to the pain. If you react to the pain, it intensifies it. It makes it worse. It makes it far, far worse. And I've saw that with other cancer patients. Not with all of them. I met some remarkable people, actually, but who dealt with it very, very positively. But most people don't. But that's the key to any kind of pain or suffering. Just don't react to it. Just let it in. It's there. You can't push away something like the pain that you get from chemotherapy, all the minor ailments that it afflicts you with, for example. Yes, yeah, so your attitude to pain is key, and a key Buddhist teaching is, which I've always tried to take seriously throughout my life, is to make the most of adversity. And I took that, I tried to take that a stage even further with the cancer diagnosis, which was, I thought, well, you know, there's only one way forward here. I've got to welcome it. You know, actually, more than make the most of it, just welcome it. Don't fight it. It's there. I can't stop it. But that didn't mean to say surrendering to it. I dealt with it as positively as I could within my own mind. And that's the way forward.
There's almost a suggestion of what you're saying as well, that that's the part as well. So you're saying make the most of it.
Yeah.
Well,
definitely, because unfortunately it seems to be the case that we grow through pain. I wish it was different, but, you know, if I'm frank, if I look back over my life, as I frequently do at this stage, the most painful moments in my life have probably been the most productive. I wouldn't have wished those experiences upon myself, but it's what life threw at me, and I tried to learn from them and rise to them as a challenge, and that's been my attitude for many, many years, and it pays dividends. It really does. Anyway, we've gone over time. Time to stop. So, I'm afraid I can't.